I'm Jordan Myers.
I mean, this is just bullshit.
Well, no, that's a bunch of bullshit.
This is bullshit.
Well, that's very nice bullshit, Rip.
You know what? That's bullshit.
And you're listening to That's BS. Before we begin today, I just wanted to kind of make a proposition to you. If you listen to this episode in part or in its entirety, and you learn something that you didn't know before, or your mind has changed on something, consider giving us just $1 a month on Patreon. That would cost you actually $12 a year. And if everyone did that, it would help us to cover the costs of this podcast. I'm actually paying money right now to create this, which I love doing, don't get me wrong. But it would be nice if I could get out of the red. So that's my proposition to you. You can take it or not. But if you listen to this episode and you learn something or your mind was changed, well then just consider going to our Patreon. You can find it at patreon.com/thatsbs. And of course, you'll be rewarded for your donation as well. Thanks for listening, and here's the episode. Welcome to That's BS. I'm Jordan Myers, and today I have a very special guest, Iona Italia. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes, is Italia.
Okay. She has very graciously agreed to join me for today's episode. So before we begin, Iona, can you give everyone your kind of short form bio, tell them what you're working on?
Sure. So I'm the sub-editor at Ario Magazine. So I'm Helen Pluckrose's second in command, her first officer, as I like to put it. And I am also an epistolatrix at LetterWiki. So Letter is a new platform where basically you can write letters to each other in digital form publicly. So you sign up with another person or write to someone who's already on Letter and set up a public digital correspondence. So I have a weekly column for Letter that we're publishing in Ario, because Letter and Ario are partnering. So every week I describe a different conversation and give my take on it. And I think you read the one on free will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did. And I very much enjoyed it. And I wanted to... Yeah, you're welcome. And I wanted to talk to you about that. But first, I mean, that's just about LetterWiki.
One more thing I want to mention, and I also have my own podcast. I'm sorry, I am your rival.
That's true.
which is called Two for Tea.
Yeah, I've listened to a tiny bit of the episode that you and Helen Pluckrose did with the Rathbone brothers. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes, Dane and Clyde Rathbone. So yeah. They're the founders of Letter. Mm-hmm. They're my... Well, they insist that they're not my employers, that we work together. Mm-hmm. So they are my colleagues on Letter.
Yeah, and they, I believe, have also agreed to come and talk to me about LetterWiki. So I'm looking forward I'm looking forward to that too.
That's excellent.
Mm-hmm. So that's it's a cool idea. So they are two different magazines that sort of partner together?
Well, Letter is not a magazine. Mm. It's a website/app. Mm-hmm. So it's like a social media website, except that what you do on Letter is write open letters to each other. So on Letter, you have a one-on-one conversation in the form of letters. So say you and I are both signed up to Letter, then I write Dear Jordan and I begin a letter. And there's a maximum word length. The minimum is about one paragraph. And the maximum is like the equivalent of a couple of pages. Mm-hmm. And then I sign off, love, Iona. And then you go in and you answer that letter. And then I answer you, and we build up a conversation that way. And the letters are public, and you can share them on social media. But there are no likes or comments. So it doesn't have the gladiatorial feel that Twitter has, for example. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that because there aren't any third parties interjecting or derailing the conversation or applauding or jibing at you or whatever else, you're not tempted to to perform for an audience like people do in Twitter, where they quote tweet each other and things like that. Mm-hmm. I quote tweet you for my audience so that they can all see how clever I am and what an idiot you are. You quote me for your audience. That's how Twitter works lots of the time. So the idea of letter is that instead of talking at or about each other, we will talk to each other directly in letters.
Mm.
On any topic. It doesn't have to be political. It doesn't have to be a disagreement.
Mm-hmm.
Can be on any subject. I would say that they have been, about half have been personal topics and about half have been political.
That's very cool. I like the idea of removing the point scoring. And, you know, trying to get the applause and admiration of each side and just getting down to actually talking as you and I would right now.
Yes, Twitter is so performative.
Yes, it's awful.
I can't help it. I keep making this resolution not to quote tweet anymore, and then I just can't resist it.
Yeah.
and sometimes it's like two different worlds. You know, on my page, everybody will be saying, Jordan is a complete wanker. You so owned him. And on your page, everyone will be saying, Iona is such an idiot. You completely owned her. It's like two parallel worlds.
And the worst part is that you and I could be friends. And people are just, you know, quoting each other for our own teams that we don't even want to be, you know, adversarial towards each other.
That can happen too. Yeah. That's right. Yes. Yeah.
No, unfortunately, there are people getting paid a lot of money to make sure that you and I are addicted to Twitter. So they're doing a good job.
Yeah, they're doing an excellent job in my case. But I also do feel that Twitter, so there's that element of it, the adversarial, the fact that it encourages snarkiness. Mm-hmm. But also the other element is the internet addiction. Think that I think that if I didn't have to be on Twitter, I really need to promote the Aereo articles and get guests for my podcast. And I have also made quite a lot of real life friends on Twitter. So when I went to live in India and I didn't know anyone there at all, and most of my friends I made through Twitter.
Huh.
My real life friends. I mean, then I hung out with them in real life.
Yeah,
but I initially met them on Twitter, so it can be useful in that way. But the downside is that you can fritter away so much time, and afterwards you don't feel as though you've done anything productive.
Yes,
you just wasted your life, and we really don't want. You can't do that on letter. You can't really scroll and read tiny snippets on letter in quite the same way. And so the idea is that when you're on letter, you're either reading a longer form conversation because that is of interest to you, or you are having a more worthwhile interaction. And so when you log off, we don't want you to feel that was such a waste of time and I wish I hadn't done that. We don't want to kind of hook you in just to sort of make a buck,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and have you feel bad about yourself for having spent time on the site.
Yeah. No, I am often filled with paradoxical remorse every time I get off of Twitter, because it's weird. I mean, Twitter is the only reason why I'm talking to you now is because, you know, I found you through Helen, who I found through, you know, someone else, and now we're talking, which is great. But at the same time, you know, I can close Twitter on my phone and say that's enough for the day, and then just reflexively open the app. Like as soon as I said that's enough for the day, it's crazy.
I have to set up all kinds of I have to set up all kinds of handicaps for myself,
mm-hmm,
to prevent myself from using it. You know, I have to lock my phone in a cupboard in another room and block myself on the computer, and it's really. I think it's partly addictive because I think that if you're very interested in politics and public affairs, then it's really hard to talk about that except on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
None of my real-life friends are interested in are much interested in those topics. Actually, I do have a real-life friend who is quite interested, and we would get together once a week and have supper, and that really helped me. I was less crazy on Twitter because I knew that I could talk to him about things. Mm-hmm. But it's also become my source of news. I don't read any newspapers anymore. I just follow specific journalists, mostly Indian journalists. And so, you know, all my interaction with the kind of wider political world is through reading things on Twitter and arguing with people on Twitter, which is probably not that good. And I've become used to, because of Twitch, I've become used to never keeping my opinions to myself. And I always have been very verbose. And Twitter just makes that worse. You have some random thought and you immediately feel, I want to go and share it with the world now.
Yeah. It is this sort
You can't just appreciate it for itself. As Helen said, she's found that she's no longer capable of just thinking something without telling people.
Yeah, which is strange. It's,
yeah.
There's no pre-Twitter analog for that. Like, if you just went around the town square shouting your thoughts at everyone, you'd be kind of branded a crazy person, and no one would really speak to you.
Right.
But if you do that, you're just the average Twitter user.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it can be very, it can feel very warm, give you warm, fuzzy, nice feelings. And that keeps you hooked, and then you also get all the negative stuff, like feeling like you're actually wasting your time procrastinating, feeling as though you're living online rather than living in real life, which is so psychologically unsatisfying. Mm-hmm. I think someone said it's like the aspartame of conversation. It gives you that kind of... similar sort of hit, but your body knows it's not real sugar. It's the worst of both worlds. It's not healthy, but you didn't actually have a proper treat.
Yeah, that's a great analogy for it. That's great. So yeah, no, I'm looking forward to I discovered Aereo magazine after talking with Helen, and I discovered Letter after talking with you on Twitter. So I'm very interested to delve deeper into both. But I know one thing that I found really interesting on Aereo was your post that you made called On Free Will, a Letter Exchange. And I believe this was your, if I understand it correctly, this is your kind of commentary on the letter exchange between Benjamin Burgess and John Rosen. That's correct?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, cool.
Malbec.
Oh, nice, cheers. Nice. I have a little bit of beer myself. Cheers.
Cheers. Oh, I would have thought that was water.
No, it's...
You could have kept that discreetly secret.
No, now I've ruined it. Now everyone knows. It's a good short read, especially as sort of an introduction to a lot of the issues in this field of study. And it's a very deep field of study. We could talk for days upon days about it, for sure. But... this is a great, dipping your toe into the water of questions of free will and determinism and what those views have to do with moral responsibility. So did you have any a role in setting this conversation up, or you just noticed it?
No, not at all. So my role at Ledger is that one of my roles, I think the most onerous of my roles, maybe, onerous is the wrong word, most time-consuming, is that I write an article on a Ledger conversation every week, or almost every week. And I either pick, or between us, Dane and Clyde, and I pick the conversation that we think is the most interesting. Actually, the second one that I did was one of my own conversations, but not just because I adore myself, I'm a complete narcissist, but because we wanted to record that. And I didn't know whether I had permission to record other people, so I just took my own conversation because I knew I could give myself permission. Mm-hmm. But apart from that, I don't know from week to week which conversation I'm going to choose and what topic it will be on. Mm-hmm. And so it may require a little bit of research. And in the case of the free will, that was my first. I read Sam Harris's short book, Free Will, quite a long time ago. I think when it first came out, which I don't remember now.
I want to say 2012, but I could be just, you know,
yes,
I could be very wrong. I don't know.
I was thinking also around. So, yeah, his first book was in 2011 because his first book, The End of Faith, he started writing it immediately after 9/11, a few days after 9/11.
I think that was in 2004, actually, that came out. The End of Faith? Yeah, I believe so.
Wait. 9/11 was not 2011.
No.
What did I say?
2001.
I only just took the first sip.
Yeah.
Oh. Of this one.
It's okay. It's almost the same year. It's just a decade off.
Yeah. No, it was... Yes. So it was... what year was 9/11?
2001.
2001.
So I think his book came out in 2004.
Okay, so he was quite a slow writer. So he started writing it immediately after 9/11. So, I want to say it was around 2009 or 10, somewhere around.
It sounds
there.
About
anyway,
right.
I remember it had just came out when I read it. And I was very struck by it, and I find it intuitively convincing. Mm. Although I obviously behave as if I have free will, and also I practice a religion. I'm not even an atheist. So I'm completely, totally confused. It's just a big mess in here.
Yeah.
So I read some other writings in preparation for doing the article. But basically I think with most of these articles, it's my first deep dive into the topic. So I spend a few days researching and then I write it. The other one that I recently wrote was about human cultural evolution and multi-level selection theory. And I also didn't know anything about that and went to research it.
Yeah. That's a very cool writing style,
yeah,
though.
It's a layperson's take.
Mm-hmm. That's very cool. So you've basically set up your job so that you get to learn something new every week and then write about it. That's very cool.
Yes, it's fun. It's a lot of fun.
I'm jealous. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. So if I recall correctly, the basic premise. So you referenced Sam Harris. He would describe himself as arguing for firstly, he would argue for determinism, which basically states that all of our actions are caused by either, you know, the deterministic factors of the universe outside of our control, or by random causes in the universe, which are also outside of our control. And then he uses that conclusion to then go towards an abdication, I guess, in a certain sense, of moral responsibility. So he is an incompatibilist. He would believe that that if determinism is true, then moral responsibility and blameworthiness don't make any sense. And so those are kind of two separate issues, but he links them together. He thinks one follows from the other.
I see. I'm not really sure what you mean by moral responsibility.
It's a good question. And that the definition of that term actually is the topic of a lot of papers on this subject. But basically, moral responsibility. Have you ever heard of the philosopher named P.F. Strawson?
No.
Okay. He wrote this kind of landmark paper on moral responsibility. In, I should know the year. I think it was the 70s, maybe the 60s. But he really set the terms for the debate on this. And he coined these two types of attitudes we have towards other people. One is called the reactive attitude. So it, you know, like the name sounds, it's reactionary. So if you wrong me in some way, you know, say you lie about, you know, me to your friends and you defame my reputation. And I discover this, I would be reactive towards you if I, you know, was angry with you. I said, Iona, how could you have done this? You know, we're friends. It, you know, I am holding you responsible for that. That would be an example of a reactive attitude. An objective attitude is the other kind, where, to follow the analogy, if you, you know, you wronged me in that way, I could sit back and I could say, well, you know, I'm not really going to get angry with you because you didn't really choose that action, because you didn't build yourself. You didn't choose your genes, your experiences, your, you know, family growing up. You didn't choose any of the circumstances of your birth. So how could you possibly be responsible for your actions now? And me getting angry with you isn't going to do anything. So I will just, you know, I'll kind of treat you as this object to be worked around and see how I can repair my reputation without actually holding you responsible. So that would be two types of attitudes that Strawson introduces.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, I think being angry is not incompatible with not, at some level, at one level, not believing in free will. So thinking that ultimately you are not responsible. In that sense, ethically responsible. And being angry are completely compatible responses. Mm-hmm. As I said in the article, quoting Will Storr, who among us has not told a self-assembly wardrobe to fuck off?
Yeah, I loved that quote.
And there's no real way of behaving as if you and I are automata.
Mm-hmm.
Even if I don't believe we have free will, still I'm going to feel, I'm going to act and feel as though we do. There's no way of escaping from that.
That's interesting, because that's exactly what P.F. Strawson says. He says that, you know, even if we grant that, you know, determinism is true, we still have to treat each other as responsible, just as an aspect of who we are, which is interesting. But I guess I wanted to ask, what specifically did you find convincing in Harris's book or in arguments for determinism generally?
What did I find convincing?
Mm-hmm.
I feel as though I don't know.
You said you had conflicting intuitions on this, right?
I had conflicting intuitions. Yeah, but I'm. I think there are two things. There's kind of intuition,
mm-hmm.
And there is being intellectually convinced. So I think it's impossible to escape from the intuition that you have free will.
Mm. Okay. Interesting.
I think maybe one of the things that you don't have free will about is believing that you have free will. You can't help it.
Yeah.
It's ingrained. And... So, but that's different from being convinced by an intellectual argument. There are many things in science which are extremely counterintuitive and go against common sense. And you can understand them on an intellectual level, but your intuition still point in a different way.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I wonder... And what you might have to say to someone who practices Buddhist meditation, someone like actually Sam Harris, actually, he says that he, you know, through introspection and kind of watching his own mind, he actually can see through the illusion of free will. Do you think that that's possible, or is he kind of, is he bullshitting us in a way?
Does he say he can see through the illusion of free will? Isn't it the illusion of self?
Well, he would, yeah, so there's a lot of illusions, I guess, that he thinks that he can see through. The illusion of the self is one of them, but it's, I guess it's related to, but different than the illusion of free will.
Yes, I think so. But the meditation, I think, is mostly concerned with the idea of the self.
Mm-hmm.
So the way in which it impinges on free will is that if when you meditate, you notice how thoughts come to your mind unbidden and how difficult it is to control your focus of concentration,
mm-hmm.
which brings us back to the Twitter addiction.
Exactly.
that the, you know, there's the famous thing that you can't not think about a white bear.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very hard to control your thoughts. In the Zoroastrian religion, which I practice, the kind of key motto is good thoughts, good words, good deeds.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always found that a little bit counterintuitive because you can't control your thoughts.
Mm.
So I see it as more like try not to wallow in the bad thoughts.
Okay.
Try to focus on better thoughts, to be happier. And if you're happier, you'll be able to live a better life.
And we were talking about the possibility of that from an introspective position. So I guess the claim is that if you pay attention sufficiently closely enough to your own mind, you can see like the thoughts arise from nowhere, in a sense.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. Right, so that is connected, in a sense that's connected to free will, although it's only specific to the thoughts, and in meditation you're supposed to observe. So who is doing the observe? If you don't have any free will, how can you choose whether or not to observe? I don't think it really goes to the heart of the free will issue.
Interesting. Okay.
This idea that your thoughts are unbidden. Because you have so many thoughts that you don't act upon.
Mm-hmm.
So you could also, it's perfectly coherent to have a position that says that your thoughts are unbidden, but among those thoughts, you pick and choose the ones that you are going to act upon or speak out loud, etc. Mm-hmm. So there's still an element of free will is still there.
Okay, so that this position would be admitting that you don't really choose what thoughts kind of arise out of nowhere, but you can choose which ones that you go with or not. Is that their position?
Yeah.
Okay.
That would be a possible position, I think.
I guess I wonder, so I guess they would be differentiating the thoughts from whether or not you act on them. So I'm struggling to see where free will would come into the mix there. Because if you, like, for instance, if I, you know, tomorrow, pretend I'm just going about my normal day and I have two conflicting thoughts. One thought is, let's have, you know, donuts for breakfast and watch Netflix. And my second thought is, no, come on. Like, let's really get up. Let's have, you know, eggs and toast, and then let's go for a run. And those are my two kind of competing.
How did you get inside my head? That's uncanny.
those are my thoughts every morning.
Yeah, mine too.
So if I wake up and I'm kind of toying with these two possibilities for my day, or at least the start of my day, and I, you know, let's say on Friday, tomorrow, I'm, you know, I'm hungover, I'm tired, and I just say, oh, you know, screw it, I'm just gonna stay in bed, have a few donuts, and we'll start tomorrow. And then Saturday, the next day comes around, and I wake up, and this question hits me again, And I think, no, come on. Like we've got to, you know, we can pull this through. Let's get up. I force myself to get up. I force myself to eat the right breakfast and go on a run. Now, both of those thoughts occurred to me, which I would agree. I had no free will in choosing whether or not they came up. But to be honest, I don't really understand what free will I had in choosing which plan to follow either day. Right? It's sort of inscrutable to me.
Right. Me too. Mm-hmm. And that's why I don't believe in free will. But I think that that is not because the thoughts are unbidden, but because I think that you not only don't have freedom to control what you think, but you don't have a fundamental freedom to choose how you act, what you do.
Mm-hmm.
So although it feels, you feel as though you do.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that meditation itself gives us any special insights into whether or not we have free will. I don't know how relevant this is because, as I said, I'm not a professional philosopher, so I'm just bullshitting here. But I often think about this story that a friend of mine told. My friend Jamila, she went on a date with this guy, and they were having getting intimate, and he was trying to persuade her to sleep with him, and she said, "No, I don't want to." And he said, "Well, I can feel that your body is responding to me," and she said, it's what she said that I remembered. She said, "My body, yes, but my body's not the boss here. I am."
Hmm.
I think about that a lot. And, you know, when people say, "Listen to your body," I don't listen to my body. My body is a fucking idiot. You know, my body wants to lie in bed eating the donuts, watching Battlestar Galactica on reruns.
Mm-hmm.
There is this kind of sense of a struggle between different parts of the self, but all of that may be very much an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not convinced by the idea that there is no self.
Okay, interesting.
I think that I do have a consciousness. Everything else may be illusion, may be an illusion. You may not be here at all. I may just have forgotten to take my meds.
Let's hope not for my sake. I want to be here.
Well, you would say that.
Exactly.
Figure in my dream.
Exactly.
I could be in a coma right now, a brain in a vat or whatever, but I know that there is something here that is thinking and feeling, and that's consciousness itself. That's the only thing that I can be certain of.
Okay.
But I think I can be certain of that.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Have you, I know you're a sci-fi geek. Have you ever heard of the transporter problem?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
Do you have a strong opinion on it? I'm curious now.
Maybe
we should clarify what that is for our listeners.
Yes. Go ahead.
So the transporter problem is, it's derivative of Star Trek, I believe. So if people aren't familiar, in Star Trek, you kind of, when you are beamed up or down from a planet, you get on this platform and you say, you know, "Scotty, beam me down." And from what I understand, the principle of it is that your atoms are broken apart, beamed down to the planet, and then reassembled in exactly the configuration and with the same electron spin. Everything is the exact same. And you're reconstituted on the planet. And there's this big divide between people of whether that is akin to murder every time that happens, or if that is just, if that's just people, you know, moving around like cars. So do you have a strong opinion?
I think, I mean, isn't what happens in the transporter just a speeded up version of what happens anyway? I guess there are certain cells that you do have for life, like cells within your ovaries, egg cells. As a woman, as a man, you you don't have long-standing germ cells. You just recycle every 36 hours.
Yeah.
My eggs, which are probably not in that great a shape anymore now that I'm 50, but have been there since before I was born. And then also the neurons remain the same, except you lose some as you get older. But all your other cells recycle, right?
Yeah, from what I understand, I think your body recycles every cell about 6 years in cyclical order like that.
So the question is, it's the ship of Theseus problem.
Mm-hmm.
I think everybody knows that problem.
I'm sure they do.
Theseus's ships had been, every single plank had been replaced many times over. Once every plank has been replaced, is it really still the same ship? Mm-hmm. As you're replacing them one by one. So I think that the kind of atoms reconstituting is not really a problem. That happens anyway. The problem is is what happens to your consciousness when you go through the transporter. I don't know. I mean, there are, of course, characters in Star Trek who do not want to take the transporter.
Yeah.
Like McCoy in the original series doesn't like getting into the transporter. He doesn't trust that thing. And Reginald Barclay who is a terrible hypochondriac, is afraid of transporter psychosis, as a psychiatric condition of which there has only been one example within the last 700 years of Federation history or something.
Yeah. I was just saying, I think I would be with the people who didn't want to get into the transporter.
Really?
Yeah.
I think I would be like Barclay in another way. Barclay has holodeck addiction, and that's very similar to Twitter addiction, except worse.
Yeah.
It's really the epitome of an echo chamber, a bubble, because he recreates the people he knows in real life, but in versions that are just pander to all his fantasies.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
It's creepy and sick and completely understandable. I mean, wouldn't you do that too? I'm so glad we don't have holodecks.
Yeah, that'd be terrible.
And I always, I was pointing out the other day that if you compare Tom Paris on Voyager and Lee Adama on Battlestar Galactica, and you look at Lee's physique versus Tom Paris's physique, that Tom Paris is really wimpy and Lee Adama is just like, this is peak performance for the male body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the secret is, there ain't no holodeck on Battlestar Galactica.
Mm.
So when he's bored, he goes to the gym, whereas Tom Paris spends all his free time in his hollow, playing at his hollow novels.
Yeah. Yeah.
Playing his games. No, I would happily get on the transporter. I mean, there are occasional accidents, like when Riker's was duplicated and ended up having this evil twin.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, you know, there are many airplane accidents. Well, not many, but there are airplane accidents, and I still fly mm-hmm. on planes.
Yeah.
Well, I get into cars, and even on the back of... in India, I had to ride on the back of mopeds a lot.
Oh, wow.
And there are a lot of accidents on those things.
Yeah, I can imagine.
That does not feel safe, but I will still do it because the odds are quite small and the convenience is great.
Yeah, we're not very good at judging what is probably actually going to kill us in the end, because most people will happily eat too much salt and too much fat and too many cheeseburgers, but... will, you know, be afraid when an airplane takes off, and that's just not likely to kill you at all.
Well, with nutrition, you have a nice get out because it's not really known how we really don't know how you should eat.
Hmm.
I think everyone agrees that you should probably drink less alcohol. I look at my glass of Malbec. And sugar is probably not great for you. But beyond that, the new orthodoxy seems to be that you should eat a lot of salt and you should get at least 80% of your calories from saturated fat.
That's true, yeah.
Turns things on its head.
Yeah.
So basically, I think we don't know, and that gives us a nice get out.
That's true. You're referencing the ketogenic diet,
probably,
right?
Probably donuts and Netflix all day is probably not that healthy then.
Yeah, no, we can confidently say that that is not a healthy lifestyle.
Well, for now, I'm waiting for science to tell me that that's actually the ideal.
I don't think we should bet on that, but it'd be nice. Have you ever heard of, you touched on something else that I thought was interesting in the Star Trek discussion. Have you ever heard of the writer Robert Nozick and his experience machine?
Yes, this rings a bell.
Yeah.
I'm afraid it's somewhere in the lumber yard of my of the hinter part of my brain.
Well, because you were referencing, the difference in the two crew members, one who has the holodeck where he can just create reality for himself, and so his actual body is kind of withered away, and he's not very strong and active. And
It's not withered away. Let's not be too hard on this. We're actors.
Sure. It's not withered, but it's not the body of the other man who actually works out and keeps himself in good physique.
And
so that's sort of similar to this. So this thought experiment that Robert Nozick came up with, called the experience machine, where he asks, so if we had this machine that could, plug into the back of your brain and give you any experience you want. So you could, before going into the machine, say, I'm going to stay in this machine for 5 days. And during those 5 days, I want to experience, myself going on a trip, getting into a bar fight in a foreign land, sweeping this, foreign lady off of her feet. We have a romantic evening together. I am the, the male bravado incarnated. And then I fly back. I barely escape death. And I am just this macho hero, and it's an amazing 5 days. But of course, during those actual 5 days, you're sitting in a chair in some industrial park and you're plugged into this machine. So there's two questions that Robert Nozick asks us. And the first one is would you plug into this machine at all? And if so, how much time would you spend in it? And then the second question is, what if you had to choose whether to get into this machine for the rest of your life or never get into it at all? What would you do?
Right. So I'm really glad this machine does not exist.
Yeah.
I don't think I could do moderation with the machine. Mm. I think that would be very, very difficult. Given the last choice, then I definitely wouldn't get in at all. So what's missing in the machine is connection.
Mm-hmm.
Other people. Other people within the machine are just figments of your fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have a machine like this, of course, when we're asleep. It's when we're dreaming.
Yeah.
And I often have this very disappointed sensation when I wake up. So I frequently remember my dreams. I do have a lot of nightmares as well. And I have this continuing nightmare that I wake up to find that I have killed someone in my sleep. So within my dream, I wake up. I have a lot of these dreams where I wake up within the dream. It's very unnerving because within the dream, I actually think I'm awake.
Wow.
And I wake up to find there's a corpse lying there on the floor. And I know that I was the one to have killed this person. But I can't remember exactly how it happened. And then I have to dispose of the body. This is a recurring nightmare of mine. So probably I am a psychopath. And I'm always enormously relieved when I wake up from that dream. But I also have dreams which I'm really sad to wake up from. Mm-hmm. And I'm sort of clinging on to the dream.
Mm-hmm.
I also indulge in a lot of daydreaming. I'm a very inveterate daydreamer. But there's something very hollow about all of these things, the dreams, the daydreams, the even the online interactions with people. It's not real, and it's not real because there's no one else there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess you kind of hint at like an interesting thing that we clearly crave like happiness or pleasurable experiences or whatever you'd like to call it, but we also crave knowing that those are actually real in some sense. So if we could get fake versions of that, we would be satisfied, but not for very long.
I think that yeah. If we could both go into the dream together, so in the same way as, since we're on the topic of sci-fi, in the Orville, where the doctor, whose name I have now forgotten, it's my name, aphasia, is playing up again. The doctor on the Orville, who is her lover, is a robot.
Mm. Okay.
Isaac, and so she is not in real life. She can't even kiss him. He doesn't even really have a face. He just has this completely smooth metal head thing with two glowing red eyes. But they have a holodeck program, and he is able to go into the holodeck with her, and in the holodeck he has a body, human body. And the experience is not real, but they go into the holodeck to have the experience together. So if I could go into the experience machine with someone else, even if not physically, if someone else was also hooked up to the machine, but we were both somehow inside the same dream or fantasy, then I would do it.
Interesting.
It's not the fact that it's not real that is the problem. It's the fact that it's not shared. There's no connection with anyone else.
Yeah. What's interesting, I guess, is that Nozick challenges people like yourself and says, but, you know, don't you understand you could program the experience to have people from your actual life in it? And you, once you were in the experience, would think it was actually them.
I would think it was actually them, but it wouldn't actually be them, would it?
No, it wouldn't be. It would just be some sort of artificial copy of them, in a way.
Yeah. No, I needed a multiplayer experience.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I wouldn't get into the machine either. I would definitely do it for short stretches if I could just get in and out as I pleased. But if I was faced with the decision of, for the rest of my life, will I spend it in the machine or not, I think I would choose to not.
I don't know if I would do it for short stretches, to be honest, because I would be afraid of the addictive potential.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. It would be a slippery slope, I imagine.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Well, I feel as though this is true, however, of so many things. There are so many things out there that I want to have in my life and enjoy in moderation. It's dangerous. You know, there's 1,000 quicksands that you can get stuck into. I don't know if you've seen the Portlandia sketch where they're watching Battlestar Galactica.
No, I haven't.
So I have been rewatching Battlestar Galactica, which I watched when it first came out, which was, I think, in 2009. And I'm blessed with tremendous forgetfulness when it comes to plot, which is really an advantage because you can enjoy things a second time almost as much as you can the first time, as long as you leave enough intervening time in the intervening period. And every time it's like, okay, I'm only going to watch one episode and then I'm going to switch my computer off and go to sleep.
Yeah.
Oh, well, maybe just one more episode. Maybe I can just watch a third episode.
I'm the same way.
I saw this Portlandia sketch where they begin watching Battlestar Galactica right at the beginning. And by the end, they've watched it. They've watched the entire thing. And they both lost their jobs because they didn't go into work. And it's really frighteningly believable, this sketch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so you're afraid that that would happen with you and the experience machine.
Yes, basically. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very valid concern. I wanted to circle back around, actually. You mentioned something that was interesting. You said you were a practitioner of Zoroastrianism.
Yes.
Okay.
I guess, yeah.
Cool. I know nothing about that. Can you explain that to me?
So I am a Parsi, and so therefore, I guess I could have left the religion and I could be an atheist, but my father was Parsi, so I'm Parsi, and Parsi is the ethnicity and Zoroastrianism is the religion.
Okay.
So I don't really do anything to practice when I'm outside India. Hmm. I don't pray at home or anything like that. Although you're supposed to, but I go when I'm in India. I go to the Agiari, to the fire temple, and yeah.
Hmm. So does that, I'm just curious, does that entail any metaphysical otherworldly beliefs, or is that sort of is it a cultural practice more of that?
For me, it's mostly a cultural practice.
Okay.
It's mostly kind of cultural, historical, but I don't describe myself as an atheist because I do try to connect with something.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anyone up there? It seems highly unlikely. Is there any reason to think the person up there is actually called Ahura Mazda? Did a prophet called Zoroaster actually exist? All extremely improbable. Nevertheless, I try to foster that connection.
Mm-hmm.
So I mostly like somebody who is culturally Jewish, I mm-hmm. guess. A lot of Jewish people whom I know are atheists, but they Jewish traditions, our religious traditions are meaningful to them. So I'm a little bit like that, but not white.
Okay.
Not quite. I feel that if I haven't gone to the Agiari for a long time, that something is missing. And I do have a lot of religious iconography. So I will show you.
Oh, cool.
Wait. So, for example, I have lots of pictures of Zoroaster.
Hmm, cool.
It's the opposite of Islam. We have images of the prophet. and I also wear, this is it's called a Furuhar. It's a Zoroastrian guardian angel. And it's kind of the symbol of Zoroastrianism. So in India and Parsi households, you will see this image, this symbol everywhere. People have it above their houses. They have it as fridge magnets. They have it as decals on the back window of the car, outlined in white. We had kind of stickers everywhere. Like on the cupboard, there was a sticker. There are lots of paintings and little pictures and crochet. I'm not sure what to call them. Crochet kind of banners to hang across doorways and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that this image is everywhere, and I actually don't take this off. So I wear it even in under the shower. I never take this necklace off.
Hmm.
So I'm quite. I guess I'm also. I'm a little bit religious, not very spiritual. I'm a little bit spiritual, and I'm somewhat superstitious also.
Interesting. Do you find that kind of being a member of a specific set of ideas helps you to connect with the practice more?
Yes. I think that you can't... I find it useful to have a framework. You can just try to be a good person and try to be kind of appreciative of the life that you have, of this opportunity that you have against all the odds. We are the ones who won this astronomical lottery and are actually here and exist, unless it's just the case that I forgot to take my meds. Only I'm the only one of us who exists. You can try to do that in an abstract way, but I find it much more, I personally find it more useful and more comforting to tie it to specifics.
Interesting. Yeah. Do you think that, I don't want to lead you into any controversy you don't want to wade into, but do you think that I guess I'm trying to tease apart what you think about the fact that there are a bunch of different religions that say different things and quite clearly, I guess, on my account, create a lot of real-world conflict. And I wonder if you think that that's outweighed by their benefits, or is it something we just kind of have to live with?
This is the Sam Harris question. So Sam Harris was asked, if he could abolish religion or abolish rape, he would abolish religion. And I think that, so if you gave me that actual choice and real power, I mean, that's a really outlandish hypothetical. And I think that hypotheticals are of limited value because what you think you would do in a hypothetical situation is not necessarily what you would actually do if the situation arose. I agree with Sam. I would get rid of religion. I think it's a net negative.
Mm-hmm.
But given that I don't have that power, I don't think that, I don't think my practice of religion is a net negative. And there are a few things about Zoroastrianism I'm not crazy about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not fond of very orthodox or authoritarian versions of any religion.
Mm-hmm.
And I am also very suspicious of priests.
Yes, as you should be. Yeah.
I'm not just Catholic, but any kind of priest, including Zoroastrian priests. Mm-hmm. And we have a hereditary priesthood.
Oh, interesting.
So it's not even meritocracy.
Yeah, it doesn't even take a good priest to be a priest. You just have to have the right father priest, I suppose.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Actually, you don't even have to believe. You can be an atheist priest. It's not important. It's a hereditary position.
Okay, interesting. So again,
it's a cost.
Yeah. Paralleling Judaism, I guess, in a way, where you don't really have to believe a whole lot in order to be in.
Right.
Yeah. That's interesting, though. I guess, so I come at it from, a slightly different perspective. My family and extended family, nuclear family, it was all... still are evangelical Christians, so I quite clearly don't believe in that, and have seen in the U.S. where I'm in the quite obvious perils that religion has brought the U.S. And I know that we're a very specific, outlandish example of that. But to circle back really quick, I want to defend you and Sam for a second. Because that Well, the question that
Dan
you
got so much flack for that.
He did, yeah.
But I mean, if you're going to play with philosophical hypotheticals, the point is to make them extreme.
Mm-hmm.
If you asked, would you abolish religion or abolish chocolate fudge sundaes? You know, it's not a difficult question. You have to make the question difficult, which means that the choice has to be a hard choice.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it makes no sense as a thought experiment.
Yeah, yeah. And also the important thing is also, Sam, and I guess you would agree, Sam is quite explicitly ascribing many rapes to religion. So, for instance, you know, the fact...
Quite rightly.
Mm-hmm, yeah, yeah. I mean, the Catholic Church, for example, you know, shuttling priests from parish to parish who, you know, rape young boys, and the inspired religious rapes that went on in a... I guess it was a conflict. I don't remember the name of it. But I remember it was two Islamic countries, and one raped systematically the women of the other side because they knew that it would demoralize them on their religious textual grounds.
Well, that's also happened during the Yugoslavian conflict,
mm-hmm.
and then it was Catholics who raped Muslim women, was used as a weapon of war.
Yeah.
And you also have things like in Hinduism, you have a lot of child brides, you mm-hmm. have arranged marriages, often with women who are very young, and there's is that not a form of rape? And of course, in Islam, you have all kinds of coercion exercised
mm-hmm.
on women. So yeah,
yeah, yeah. Not to
Sam's correct.
Yeah. Yeah, I would fully agree with you there. I know we got started late, so we don't have a whole lot of time left, but I wanted to I didn't want to totally skip out on the second article that I wanted to talk to you about, which was the article on Stoicism. And I was curious what you found, because I would call myself a casual fan of Stoicism. I don't know nearly enough about it, not nearly enough that I should, at least. But I was curious, so what did you find to be helpful, useful, attractive in Stoicism?
So I find that what I find particularly useful, and I'm going to plug Darren Brown's book here, because I think... I have read now a number of books on Stoicism, but I found Darren Brown's take on it by far the most engaging, compassionate, humane, and convincing.
Mm.
So I would highly recommend anyone who's interested in Stoicism, you should read Darren Brown's book, which is called Happy, is the title.
Mm-hmm.
I think that... and I was in the throes of a really severe depression, and that book basically eased my depression. That book was the one thing that had an impact on me, and I had cognitive behavioral therapy. I was seeing a shrink. I took antidepressants, and actually, Darren's book was the only thing that really helped me to turn the corner and come back out of this slough of despond.
Hmm.
And I find the crux of what I find helpful, I think, is the Stoic fork, as it's called, which is a fork as in a fork in the road with two paths.
Mm-hmm.
That you need to always distinguish between what you can control and what you can't control.
Mm-hmm.
And what you can't control, you need to let go of.
Mm-hmm.
You need to let go of worrying about, you need to let go of feeling responsible for, feeling guilty about, feeling inadequate because of, etc. So what you can control in Stoicism, this returns to the whole free will question, but what you can control in Stoicism is your words and actions. And what you can't control is everything else. And that includes things like whether or not your business is successful, whether you're successful in your career, because that's dependent on other people. Mm-hmm. Other people buying your product or service, hiring you. That's all dependent on what other people think about you and what you have to offer and whether it suits them. Mm-hmm. So that's all nothing to do with you.
Yeah.
You can try to stack the odds in your favor, but you can't, you have no real control.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're not success, if you're successful, that's not your own merit. And if you're unsuccessful, that's also not, it's not your fault. Then you also have no control over whether or not people like you.
Mm-hmm.
You have no control over what people say. One kind of really sort of petty, but maybe easy to understand example of the Stoic fork is weight loss. So I don't, if I want to lose weight, then I don't think, I don't try to lose weight because I don't have control over how much I weigh. I have no control over what the scale reads out. I have control over what I eat. And that's it.
Mm-hmm.
So I focus on what I'm eating or not eating, but I don't weigh myself because I don't have control over the actual scale. You can use the scale to kind of monitor, but it's like, as with so many things, it's like having a conversation with someone else. You can control what you say, but you cannot control what they say back to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we need to let go of so many of these anxieties, which are basically about other people's actions.
Yeah. No, it's a very, and again, I should read this book. And I'll order it as soon as we get off of this talk.
I loved it. And if you like audiobooks, he's a fantastic reader.
Oh, great.
So I've actually read it twice and I've listened to the audiobook twice. So I have read this book four times in a bit, which I think is the most I've read any book that I haven't been actually teaching.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet I've never read a book more than four or five times myself. It might, you know, the book that I've read the most might actually be Sam Harris's book called Spirituality, A Guide to, or what is it? No, it's Waking Up.
Waking
Sorry.
Up. Waking
yes.
Yeah.
A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion. That's the subtitle. I've read that quite a few times on audiobook and on paper.
Oh. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Have you read that? It's a great book, actually.
I have,
yeah.
Yes, I have.
Yeah, very, very useful and insightful. And on this note, I should definitely meditate more and try to be more stoic.
Well, you know, I have given up meditating.
Oh, really? Oh, why have you done that?
You know, I guess it's recommended by the Stoics. Darren Brown doesn't recommend it, or he doesn't specifically recommend you don't meditate, but he doesn't feel meditation is of a fundamental part of following the Stoic philosophy. I meditated for a year. I did meditation twice a day.
Mm-hmm.
And for about a year. And towards the end of that, I was also using Sam Harris's app.
Mm-hmm.
So I am a $1 a month subscriber to the podcast.
Yeah.
So I get the app for free. And I'm a big Harris fan, although I think he does have a few kind of glaring weaknesses, but we won't get into that. But I'm basically a fan.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't feel that it was really making any difference whatsoever.
Really?
And I don't enjoy doing it at all. So I was doing it with the hopes that it would have some effect.
Huh.
And I don't feel like it really has an effect. I don't find it particularly calming. And I don't really buy the idea of there not being a self, so I don't buy the ideology.
Mm-hmm.
And I really hate focusing on my breathing. actually, talking about the stoic fork, the one thing that, one of the things that just runs automatically, I find that focusing on my breathing makes me feel like I can't get enough air. And a couple of times I had a panic attack.
Interesting.
So, I really hate that. I hate the counting of the breath, holding your breath, and then letting the breath out really slowly. All of those kinds of things. I don't enjoy that.
Huh.
So I stopped meditating.
Huh. That's interesting. Because I had the very opposite experience of that. I think there's a noticeable difference between me when I have been meditating for months on end and me when I haven't been. But that might just be a difference in temperamental nature that neither one of us chose to have, which goes back to free will.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I think it's important to have flow in your life in the Csikszentmihalyi sense.
Hmm.
And it's important to unitask and to be fully in the moment. And there are various ways of achieving that. And I think, for example, dancing for me is a much better way of achieving that than meditating. And dancing is pleasurable in the moment in itself as well. You need both things, though. You need the kind of the enjoyment of the moment, and you need the sensation of the satisfaction of having done.
Mm.
And dancing doesn't give you any of that satisfaction of having done. So dancing and writing to me are opposites. Writing is very painful in the moment, but it feels so good to have done it.
Yes.
And then you have an object there.
Mm-hmm.
Dancing feels so fantastic in the moment, but once the moment is over, the dance is gone.
Mm.
Occasionally there's, I do have a few videos of dance performances I gave, but mostly, we don't video, and now actually it's become very almost impossible to share videos because of the new copyright laws,
mm-hmm.
because we don't own the rights to the music that we dance to. So I don't even have any recent videos of mine. Well, I have, but I can't share.
Yeah.
So mostly you have nothing to share show for it once it's over. You don't have that satisfaction of having done. And when I was dancing a lot, I was dancing for 4 or 5 hours every night.
Oh, wow.
It was really blissful, but there was a weird vertiginous feeling to it. You're kind of tightrope walking above the void.
Yeah.
There's nothing there underneath. And there's writing feels beautifully productive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It feels nice to hone the thing, and then there you have the thing.
Yeah, yeah. You have a very clear end product in writing, yes, that you don't have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even with a video of dancing, it is different than the written work that you've produced.
It is, though. It is kind of a body of. It does feel like a body of work.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true. Yeah. Well. I would love to talk more, but unfortunately, like I said, we got started late, which was my fault with the technical issues that we ran into. But I wanted to thank you again very much for coming on the show, and please tell all of my audience where they can find more of your work and Aereo magazine and letter.
Yes, and could you put links in the show notes?
Yep, absolutely.
So if they go to Aereo, A-R-E-O, aereomagazine.com is the magazine, and you can find my writings for Aereo by putting in Aereo and Iona Italia. And I also have two books. The first one is an expensive academic book, which I don't think anybody will want to buy, but it's called Anxious Employment, and my second book is called Our Tango World, and that's available on Amazon. And it's a sort of sociological study of the tango, tango and the tango society, a kind of historical sociological study. So it's not a dance book as such. It's not a kind of instructional dance book. It's about the experience of being a dancer.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also have, I am working on a parallel memoir of my childhood in Pakistan and my father's childhood in India. And I have a few little pieces that I've, that I'm making public on a blog, which is called Fire and Vultures. And then I would encourage everyone to go sign up for Letter Wiki. It's free, and you can find it at letter.wiki. And you can write to us at humans@karma.wiki.
Excellent. And like I said, I will put links in the description for everything that you just mentioned, and for your Twitter and where people can find you and contact you. But thank you again. This has been really fun talking to you, and I hope to do it again.
Thank you. My pleasure.
If you listen to this episode in part or in its entirety, and you learn something that you didn't know before, or your mind has changed on something, consider giving us just $1 a month on Patreon. That would cost you actually $12 a year. And if everyone did that, it would help us to cover the costs of this podcast. I'm actually paying money right now to create this, which I love doing, don't get me wrong. But it would be nice if I could get out of the red. So that's my proposition to you. You can take it or not. But if you listen to this episode and you learned something or your mind was changed, well then just consider going to our Patreon. You can find it at patreon.com/thatsBS. And of course, you'll be rewarded for your donation as well. Thanks for listening, and here's the episode.